Okay, a little bit of a review of what we're going to be covering today. In Proverbs 30, the last of the Proverbs texts we'll be looking at that deals with the topic of creation. And we're going to be looking at the really small creatures today. But you know, while Rich was gone on his little tour to Guatemala, we finished up the study of A Way of a Man with a Maid. But I don't think we should let Rich off the hook, should we? We'll have him give a little report as we finish that up and move on to the ants and the locusts and the conies, the small creatures, and the lizards. So, but before we get there, a couple of interesting scientific discoveries that actually pertain to what we're studying here in the text. And one has to do with, this is actually published in a British journal, and had to do with a new research done on what they call New Caledonian crows. You say they're crows, kind of like our crows, but they're smarter than our crows, although not as smart as the ravens. And this is another series of papers that's basically making the point. There's a problem with the evolutionary paradigm, which makes the point that the human properties of the mind are most closely related to the properties of chimpanzees and orangutans. And the challenge to that is we're finding that these crows and ravens excel the intellectual capability of the great apes. And so if you're trying to make an evolutionary argument, trying to explain the common ancestor for the human mind, well, it must have come from ravens and crows, because that's where we got the... Oh, somebody's claiming that your husband's a bird brain. Is that what you're trying to...
Gertrude Houston.
There you go.
Well,
okay. If you ever watch these documentaries on chimpanzees, what you'll see the parent chimpanzees doing with the children, they train the children how to find the right kind of rocks to break open the hard nuts. Because in the African jungle, they have these very hard nuts. The only way you're going to be able to break them open and get the food out is to smash them with a rock. But certain rocks do better than other rocks. And so chimpanzees will actually forage around the jungle and look for just the right kind of rock that they can use to put a nut down and smash it and get the nut to break open. But what they've discovered with these New Caledonian crows and ravens is that they're one up on the great apes, and that they'll actually get a tool and use that tool to recover a different kind of tool to get a food treat, whereas the great apes are not able to do that. They're able to use a tool to get a food treat, but not a tool to get a different kind of tool to get a food treat. Well, this particular research study, there were six biologists, looked at these crows and noticed that they actually take pieces of wood and they will shape the wood. And they're basically using, they kind of look like toothpicks, and they're using these toothpicks to get, you know, bugs out of their little holes. And so they'll poke around and get it, but what they recognize is certain kinds of spears do a better job than others. And rather than looking around for the right kind of twig, because you typically can't find one, they'll grab one and they'll spend literally 20, 30 minutes shaping that little piece of wood, shaving it down with its beak until it's just the right length, just the right strength, and the degree of sharpness that it can use it to get these bugs out. They can also use different kinds of twigs to get honey. So they're not adverse to stealing honey out of a hive, and they know that a certain kind of twig will work better for that. But what they've recognized is that the longer the crow spends designing the tool, the more likely the crow is to save the tool. In fact, what they discovered on average is that 84% of the tools that are manufactured by these crows are saved. And what the crow basically does is it finds some hole high up in a tree that's just the right size that it can put the little tool in it, and then later on when it needs the same tool, it goes back and grabs it. Or if that's not available, they'll actually bury the tool. So look for some place and they'll scratch around and get the tool nicely buried, put some stuff on top of it, and they actually remember where they left their tools, which maybe makes them smarter than us. I don't know. Right. Right. But the more time the crow spends designing the tool, the higher the probability it will actually hide the tool. And as it is, of all the tools that are manufactured, however long they take, whether it be a minute or an hour, 84% of the tools they manufacture are saved. So, and this is a feature that is unique to these crows. So it's basically making the point that you can't simply have some kind of phylogenetic tree where you say creatures that look most similar physically will also be the most similar in terms of the properties that are mine. That model really isn't working anymore. How many of you have seen the movie San Andreas? Okay, one person. No desire to see the movie San Andreas? Actually, some of what's in there is accurate. Most of what's in there is not accurate. So, and if you haven't seen the movie, it's a 9.5 earthquake that strikes right in the middle of downtown Los Angeles, and basically all the skyscrapers come tumbling down. And there's this huge rift that's opened up, and it's a typical Hollywood disaster movie, and people are screaming and yelling, running around. So, but you can't get that kind of an earthquake happening in downtown Los Angeles. In fact, the biggest earthquake you can get on land would be 8.3. That's still a bad earthquake, but nothing like what you see in the movie. And by the way, at 9.5, it wouldn't be as bad as what you saw in the movie. And you can't get that kind of a rupture either. That wouldn't happen. Now, where you get the biggest earthquakes on the planet are what we call subduction zones. And the subduction zones are offshore. There you can get magnitude 9. So whenever you have a magnitude 9 earthquake, it's always on along a subduction zone. And so, if you saw the movie, don't panic. Earthquakes that big can't happen in the Mississippi Valley. Can't happen here in L.A. or San Francisco. We can get 8s, but you can't get 9s. You can only get 9s in subduction zones. But since it is a subduction zone, you do get a tsunami. That's another thing that is kind of messed up in the movie. They had this big earthquake happening on the San Andreas Fault, causing a tsunami. That wouldn't happen. To get this tsunami, it's got to be an earthquake on the subduction zone. So wouldn't have been any tsunami. So any of the San Andreas quakes aren't going to cause tsunamis. However, a paper got published in Geophysical Research Letters just days before the movie was released. And the paper is on subduction zones. It's basically addressing the question, why are our subduction zones only generating magnitude 9 earthquakes maximum? It could be a lot worse. And so the title of the paper is, how weak is the subduction zone interface? And the paper is really making the point that subduction zones on Earth are weak. And because they're weak, we only get 9s. We don't get 10s. And you can survive a 9. Surviving a 10 or 11, that would be a big problem. So... that the paper goes into why the earthquakes along the subduction zones are weak. And it has to do with the fact that we live on a planet where we have surface water. And the oceans are relatively deep. The average depth of the oceans is, 4 kilometers? Maybe it's 4 miles. I forget which is miles or kilometers. But because we have that kind of water, and because of the fact that we have deep water coming into the subduction zones, you get what's called low temperature, high pressure water right at the places where plates are coming together. And it's that very cold, high density water that generates a chemical reaction that actually allows the plates to slip under one another. And one of the things that is manufactured is talc. Talc is a lubricant, so it helps the things slide under together. The other thing that happens is you get other hydrated minerals, which actually enables the two plates to slide effectively under one another. And the paper really makes a point, what if we didn't have that efficient hydration taking place at the subduction zones? Well, you get one of two scenarios. The earthquakes would be bigger, but then what's very interesting is they said, if it gets much bigger, then the plates lock, and you get what's called a stagnant lid, where you have no plate tectonics at all. and if you've got no plate tectonics at all, what happens is the continents wear down and you come back to the water world that we see at the beginning of Genesis 1, you know, where there was water over the whole face of the earth. Well, what you have are wind and water eroding the continents down, but it's plate tectonics that push them back up. And actually what's been happening over the past 4 billion years is that the plate tectonics has been very slightly greater than the erosion, so the continents have been growing with respect to time. But if you were to stop the subductions, then the continents would shrink and disappear, and actually you would note that the nutrient recycling you need for advanced life would disappear much more quickly. But what I found interesting is there's actually a rather narrow zone between getting efficient subduction, and to get efficient subduction you need magnitude 8 and 9 earthquakes, but because of the hydration they're only 8s and 9s, they're not 10s, and if you get anything close to a 10, the subduction actually stops. So it's actually a fine-tuning argument. It has to be just right in order to get this efficient plate tectonics to operate. So hopefully it'll make you feel a little bit better when you see one of these disaster movies. But this is a very interesting issue of geophysical research letters, in that about 6 papers were published in the same issue, basically making the same point that we see fine-tuning design in everything we think is being disastrous. Earthquakes are disastrous. Well, if we didn't have these subduction zone earthquakes, we wouldn't have continents, we wouldn't have the nutrient recycling, and you know, it has to be fine-tuned just right, and it is just right. The earthquakes are not so great that we couldn't live in cities, but they're strong enough that we have the subduction zone activity going on. In the same issue, a paper was published on hurricanes and makes the point that hurricanes could be a lot more destructive if it wasn't for the fact that hurricanes dump a lot of rain and dump it with high intensity. In fact, the point they were making is that the typical relatively large hurricane will dump the equivalent amount of water that's flowing out of the Ganges River. So every hurricane dumps that much water on the face of the earth. Excuse me. Well, quite a bit more than what Texas has been getting. So, but when a hurricane dumps that much water, the water falling through the atmosphere generates heat friction, and the heat friction takes power out of the hurricane. So instead of getting, you know, a really bad hurricane, you wind up getting a lesser hurricane. In fact, as you notice, when hurricanes move off the ocean and hit land is when they tend to dump their water. And the more water they dump, the weaker the hurricane. You've probably noticed that as hurricanes move over a landmass, they dump more and more water. As they continue to dump that water, they get weaker and weaker and weaker. So say a class 5 hurricane hits land, becomes a class 4, then a 3, then a 2, then a 1, and just a storm. That's all because of the fact that it's dumping all this water. Now, what makes it dump all that water? It's the fact that you have this hurricane and it's bringing up all of these sea salt aerosols. It's also bringing up a lot of viruses and bacteria. A.J. Roberts is going to be addressing this class, and that's her point. She's a virologist, and she's going to be bringing a talk to you about viruses in the Christian faith. And you're all going to walk away thanking God for God creating all these amazing viruses. But when it comes to rainfall on planet Earth, a lot of that rain is there because of viruses. Raindrops can't form unless they're seeded. And so it takes seeds in the atmosphere, whether they be sea salt aerosols, bits and pieces of bacteria, tiny bacteria or viruses. Those are all the seeds that make raindrops. No seeds, no rain. So you need the seeds to make the raindrops. But we live on a planet where the hurricane is going over the ocean, it's picking up a lot of sea salt aerosols. It begins to hit the land, it picks up the viruses, the bacteria, and the bacterial particles, and that dumps a whole lot of rain and weakens the hurricane. Now, say, why didn't God create the planet with no hurricanes at all? That could have been done, but what you now have is a planet that lacks a thermostat. Hurricanes are thermostats. in the sense that when the oceans get too warm, they form hurricanes, and the forming of the hurricane cools the ocean back down so we don't have a temperature problem. So we can thank God for hurricanes because they maintain the temperature balance of the oceans and the continental land masses. We can thank God for hurricanes because they dump a whole lot of water on the land masses that we need. That water, helps all of us living in the continental land masses. And dumping all that water weakens the hurricanes so we don't get too much damage from the hurricanes.
And they have solved drought situations.
It helps with the droughts. It also moves chlorophyll from the deep part of the ocean and the ocean the seashores where that can be picked up and used to feed the biomass off of our continental shelves. Yes. Okay, you're making an interesting point because they're what we call natural oil spills. And we've had some here off California. I mean, there's a lot of oil reserves underneath the continental shelf off California. And strictly by natural means, some of that oil gets exposed and you've got the equivalent of an oil spill. Now, if a pipeline breaks or a tanker breaks, that will dump oil. And now you may have a lot more oil to deal with than what nature can take care of. So you have to send in a cleaning crew, which is what happened off of Santa Barbara. But in the very same issue of Geophysical Research Letters, another paper was published about how there's a natural cleaning agent that our oceans provide. And it's what we call bromocarbons. And, bromide is kind of like chloride. It's kind of caustic. But it's also a cleaning agent. So the ocean actually produces a natural cleaning agent. However, to really get those bromocarbons out of the water and into the atmosphere where they can have a cleaning effect, you need strong winds. That's another reason to thank God for hurricanes. The hurricanes actually get a lot of these bromocarbons up out of the water, and then they can be used to clean things up. I'll get to that in a minute. That's actually buried down here. It's one of the thick papers I was going to comment on. Maybe we've got enough here in the hurricanes. Also the same issue was making the point that, these big floods that we've had in Texas and Oklahoma, there's a satellite up there actually monitoring what they call large, deep, intense precipitation events. That's a technical term for a storm that dumps a whole lot of water in a short period of time. Those are the storms that cause massive flooding, like what you've been seeing on TV in Oklahoma and Texas. But one of the points in the introduction to the research paper was, we need these things. You say, wouldn't it be great if we didn't have any floods? Well, it's when we have these events where you get intense, sudden, extensive precipitation that it actually penetrates into the underground water reservoirs, and that's the stuff we use for wells to dig water out of. And so in order to fill up those natural reservoirs, you need these very intense storms. If all you get is light rain, the stuff evaporates and you don't get to fill up the reservoirs that we need. And that's one of the benefits of what happened in Oklahoma and Texas. It literally filled up all the man-made reservoirs. The dams there are now all full. But at the same time, it fills up the natural reservoirs. And so if we don't have these intense rainfall events, then the reservoirs that we need for times when you've got long periods of drought are going to be a problem. And that's the situation you have there in Oklahoma and Texas. You got long periods of drought, then you got these periods of very intense precipitation. So we need this.
What do we have here? West Coast.
Well,
no hurricanes.
I didn't bring the paper with me, but it was also in this very issue of geophysical research letters, and saying, yeah, we're all worried about the California drought. And they said droughts like this are relatively common in California's history. And the one we're having right now is nowhere near as bad as the one we had in 75, 76, and 77. The difference is we have a lot more people living here than we did back in 75, 76, and 77. So we're feeling it more. But actually, the current drought isn't as bad as the drought we had back then, and is also making the point that we're actually seeing over the past 100 years a decline in what we call flash droughts. Now, if you've been reading the newspapers and the magazines, basically people have been telling us storms are getting worse, the weather's getting worse. Well, there's one point where the weather is not getting worse. Over the last 100 years, we've seen a significant decline in what we call flash droughts. A flash drought is where you get a period of time of 1 or 2 years where no rain falls at all. And that just tends to devastate the natural growth in that area. This is where you get the beetles taking out all of our trees, and it affects the soil. But worldwide, there's been a substantial decline in these flash droughts. So, and it's basically making a point, hey, we shouldn't be too surprised about, quote, worse weather. We've always had worse weather. It's just different kinds of worse weather. In some respects, things are actually getting better. Yeah, all of our neighbors are getting rid of their lawns. Well, where we live in Southern California, it's not like where I grew up in Vancouver, where there's enough water that you can have lush lawns with no irrigation at all. In order to have a lush lawn here in Southern California, you've got to irrigate it. And typically, too, here is that you've got to keep replacing your lawn every once in a while. Whereas if you're in a place that's naturally wet, you don't have to replace the lawns. And so basically the point is it's cheaper not to have lawns, and hey, given the water shortage we now have, we've got a problem. But I will say this, if you look at the west coast of North America, the rainfall is very stable over decades, over centuries. And the problem is when we have a drought here, if you go up to, say, British Columbia, they're being saturated with water. And we got a lot of water here. They have what they call a drought. It's what they call a drought. I think I told this story. I took my wife, Kathy, to Strathcona Park, which is in the north-central part of Vancouver Island. And I told her it's a beautiful place with thousands of waterfalls. It's gorgeous. It was. But it was a rainforest. And she says, well, if we're going to go to a rainforest, I want to go in the driest week of the year. And that's the first week of August. Well, we went, and it rained every day. But it wasn't a heavy rain. And we went to have dinner at the Strathcona Lodge. They said, oh, we're having a terrible drought this year. We're only getting a meter a month. So that's 40 inches of rain a month. And that's what they call a drought. But what's interesting about the west coast of North America is that, yeah, if it's wet there, it's dry here. If it's wet here, it's dry up there. Which is why when I was a kid in the 1950s in British Columbia, there was a major effort to say, let's build a water pipeline. And so when British Columbia's got too much water, they just send it down to California. And, hey, it can also go the other way, too. If they got too much water here, they can push it back up. But the project was never completed. Maybe now there'll be pressure to get the project done. We'll see. So, and by the way, one-third of the world's fresh-flowing water comes out of British Columbia. So they got lots of water, and they don't dam the water up. It just goes straight out into the ocean. So, yes.
One of the scientists at JPL is a climatologist. No, it wasn't him, but it was a lady. She basically, she said, your children in Southern California are going to be facing a reality that we've never faced in terms of drought. That it's going to get quite quite a bit.
Well, it could. Although maybe next year we'll get an El Nino. Last time we had an El Nino, our street got so flooded out that we had to walk a mile and a half to get to our house every day because we couldn't drive in. And we had over 60 inches of rain in our property. So it can get wet here. But yeah, the global warming models do predict that California is going to get a lot drier. And not just California, but Nevada, Arizona, Utah, the entire Southwest is going to get significantly drier. And then the East will get a lot colder, namely that New England is going to have much more severe winters. They've had several severe winters, and likewise Western Europe. I'm actually going to get to that, and then we'll get our way of a man with a maiden come up here. So we're not going to let Richard off, no. But you brought up the thing about, you know, I'll get to you in a minute, the thing about the bromocarbons, that also got published in the same issue, which is making the point that when wind and waves off the oceans basically take these bromides out of the water, they combine with these carbons, making these bromocarbons, and they actually work to destroy the ozone. Now, that's not entirely a bad thing. If the ozone shield is too good, you don't get enough ultraviolet radiation coming through from the sun to get maximal efficiency with photosynthetic plants. Photosynthetic plants need ultraviolet radiation, and too much of an ozone shield means it will not get sufficient. Too little of an ozone shield, however, means that you're going to get the UVB coming through. There's UVA and UVB. UVA is longer wavelength. B is a shorter wavelength. The A is what the photosynthetic plants need. But the really short ultraviolet stuff, the B, is what brings you skin cancer, sunburn, scorches the plants. And actually, that kind of ultraviolet radiation is bad for the photosynthetic plants. So what that means is you have to fine-tune the ozone shield. And what this paper is pointing out is that we see here on planet Earth is just enough of these bromocarbons being wafted off the ocean and up into the stratosphere that we actually get the ideal ozone shield that we need. At the same time, you get the cleansing effect, because what's happening with all the plants on the kind of the land masses is that they're producing pollutants. So, you know, you think of natural, human pollutants. I mean, yesterday was a bad smog day, I understand. Today is a good day, but yesterday was a bad day. But even if there were no people living here in L.A. at all, you'll get what's called natural smog. You get natural smog from trees, and conifers are especially bad for making smog. But at these bromocarbons that break down the smog and make the air able to be breathable again. So it's thanks to these bromocarbons that we don't get killed by the trees that surround us. And hey, trees are good for us. We want those trees. But thanks to the bromocarbons coming off the ocean, everything's just right. The ultraviolet radiation is just right. And we can thank God. There's a question here. Yeah, a magnitude 9 earthquake will shake bark off trees.
I was just trying to remember which magnitude.
Yeah. But, you know, when you see that movie and it shows all these high-rises tumbling down, our high-rises are actually designed to withstand 8s and 9s.
Really?
Yeah. So, now maybe your house won't, but a lot of our big buildings are actually designed to be able to take that degree of shaking. Matter of fact, I think that's a law here in California, that if you build a skyscraper in downtown L.A., it's got to be able to take an 8.3. As I mentioned earlier, that's the biggest earthquake that can possibly happen on the San Andreas Fault. And chances are, you're not going to get that big of an earthquake in downtown L.A., because it's going to be, you know, probably right on the San Andreas, somewhere out in Palm Springs. That's where you're going to get the big earthquakes. But that'll make things pretty bad in Palm Springs, but not nearly so bad in downtown L.A. Yes?
How far is the San Andreas from here?
How far is the San Andreas from here?
I don't mean Palm Springs. I mean, if you went straight.
Well, Lytle Creek is probably the closest place you're going to come into contact with the San Andreas. Any of you live in Upland or Rancho Cucamonga? Rancho Cucamonga, if you go to the very northeast part of Rancho Cucamonga, you're only a few miles away from the San Andreas Fault. Yes. Yeah, it goes right through Wrightwood. Palm Springs is right on the fault. Indio is right on the fault. San Francisco is right on the fault. We're a little bit far away. And actually, you can thank God that we live in a state with lots of faults. Because we have lots of faults in California. Sorry. That's it. Because we live in such a faulty state. Oh boy, this is... not going to win with this one. No, our earthquake energy doesn't dissipate as far as it would in other states. So, for example, back in the 1800s, when they had that big earthquake along the Madrid and the Mississippi Valley, because there aren't a lot of faults in that part of the United States, that actually rang all the church bells in Boston. Now, that wouldn't happen here because there's just so many faults throughout our state that it actually prevents the energy from dissipating that far. Yeah. We don't have enough church bells, okay.
Another topic, but a few weeks ago you were promising us some exciting news about research on ants. Did you do that and I missed it?
Yeah, you missed it. But, but that's why you can thank God for Rich here, because he actually gets a recording. So go to paradoxes.org and you can listen to that, yes. Replanted.
Their area by doing those reclaimed their desert by doing those kind of things with trees in the middle, and then it brought more rainfall because they have trees. And I was thinking how, you know, everybody's like not watering their lawns much, and the trees are probably suffering a bit because of it. Are we going to have like less nitrogen and then less rain? I mean, is it in some way cyclical? Or?
Well, for example, the fact that we live in a dry place and have planted so many trees actually is a problem, in that the trees are not able to get enough water to fend off the bark beetles. And so we have a lot of trees dying here. And what would be good is for us to thin those trees out so that the remaining trees would all have adequate water, because without adequate water, the tree cannot defend itself against the bark beetles. Yeah, and San Bernardino County, the tree density is too great. So it's kind of like what I was saying last week. Sometimes lumbering is a good thing. You know, why don't you harvest the healthy trees so that the rest of the trees can actually survive, where if you try to protect all the trees, they all die. If they all die, you're going to have a water problem. But hey, we get most of our rain not from the evaporation of water off of plants. We actually get it from storms coming in off the Pacific. Yes.
You know, right now the ocean temperature around the Pacific or off California is warmer than normal. And I know that, you know, part of that's it's driven from the sun, correct? You know,
right.
The ocean is holding that, and that thermal gradient is working its way to our shoreline. Because I understand the fishing is still tremendous, but that creates more evaporation, right? And that would create more of a humid, wetter environment here because we have warmer water. So would we expect that to go from one side of the pendulum to the other? That is, we're dry now, but we're in for a wet spell.
Well, we are seeing right now a warm spot on the Pacific Ocean out by the South Pacific Isles. And that's usually the harbinger of an El Nino event. So maybe next year we will have an El Nino event. What my meteorologist friends tell me is it doesn't look like it'll be like the one that dumped 60 inches of rain on us years ago. I think it was 38 inches in downtown L.A., but up in the mountains where we live, it was like 60. Yeah, they said it probably will not be that intense. But hey, anything better than the 7 or 8 inches we've been getting the last few years would be great. So.
Yeah, that was 2005.
2005 is when we had that big one.
The desert filled up too.
Right. So, but yeah, that does happen on a regular basis. and there's some evidence that that's driven by the sunspot cycle.
Right.
Because it looks like about every 22 years you get one of these events, or every 11 years. So that's why they were predicting one, because it says, hey, around about 11 years, but we'll see. Maybe it'll be next year. Okay. Let me get into the text here, unless there's another question.
Oh, yeah, there was a question.
Yes.
The earthquakes in Oklahoma that they had,
Okay.
What's the story? Okay.
I tweeted about this on my Twitter site, and it's actually also got published in the latest issue of Geophysical Research Letters. It's amazing. Sometimes you just get an issue come out where it just gives you all kinds of scientific discoveries that encourage our Christian faith. But there was actually an article in there about the Oklahoma seismic situation. And basically saying it's not fracking at all. What's happening is they discovered two new faults. So it's not just California that's got faults, Oklahoma's got faults. And they found two, and they said the two are connected. And basically what the paper is saying is Oklahoma is at risk for a magnitude 8 earthquake. So, and they thought Oklahoma was seismically safe. They said it's not seismically safe. There's a significant risk of a major earthquake. Now, just to couch it, when they said major, they said anything between a 6 and an 8 is possible. So a 6 or a 7. But the other point they made in the paper is if you look at Oklahoma City, it's not designed to handle a magnitude 6 earthquake. I mean, a magnitude 6 here in the Los Angeles Basin, basically nobody gets hurt and nothing gets damaged. You know, we lived right on top of the 6.1 earthquake. I forget the date. It was in the 1990s.
1994.
Oh, we were right on top of the epicenter. And it shook our house violently, destroyed several pieces of furniture we had in the house, but we couldn't find a dent or a scratch in the structure of the building. Everything, that's because of our building codes. But they don't have those in Oklahoma. A magnitude 6 earthquake would cause significant damage and probably a lot of loss of life. Right. Yeah. Okay. So, a few years back.
How about Texas? Is it seismically unsafe?
Well, the problem once you get outside of California, it seems like no matter where you have the earthquake energy dissipates over a large area. So it's not like here. I mean, we all remember magnitude 7.3 earthquakes that took place up in the Mojave Desert area, and yet here we hardly felt anything. You put that in some other part of the country, and hey, an earthquake of that magnitude, it's going to do significant damage over many hundreds of miles from that epicenter. So that's one thing you can thank for living here in California, is that we can have a big earthquake. And if you live 200 miles away, you hardly feel it. But that's not the case. As I mentioned, when the Madrid fault slipped, it actually rang all the church bells all over the eastern U.S. Yes?
My kids live in Oklahoma.
They live in Oklahoma?
I was just wondering, a question popped into my head. Does the season or weather, cold, hot, have anything to do with it?
Yeah, that's an urban myth that there's something called earthquake weather. I mean,
I didn't think so, but I thought maybe.
The story here in California is that it gets really hot and dry. That's earthquake weather. And, it's going to cause things to crack. Well, it might cause some of your roof tiles to crack, but it's not necessarily a harbinger of an earthquake.
But it would be worse on people.
Yeah, when it comes to earthquake prediction, the best that we can do is give you a 5-second warning. So, with a hurricane, we can give you a few days warning. With a volcano, we can give you a couple of months warning. But with an earthquake, it's like 5 seconds. So,
don't animals feel an earthquake before we do, dogs and cats?
Well, how they're actually planning, I mean, there's a thing in here in California to set up a system where everybody can get a 5-second warning. So it's still being voted on by our legislature whether to install that. Now there's already places here in California where they can do that. And here's why you get that warning. Every quake is preceded by prequake. So, for example, if you have a magnitude 7 earthquake, about 5 seconds before that magnitude 7 earthquake, you'll feel a magnitude 5.5 or 6.
Is that what the animals feel then?
That's what they feel. So they feel the precursor, and they know something's going to happen shortly thereafter. And, they may be able to sense a magnitude 3 or 4 earthquake, and therefore that would be the sign that maybe you're going to get a 6. So, but yeah, it's only a 5-second warning. So people say, watch the behavior of animals. Well, it's still only going to give you 5 seconds. And if we get this system of seismographs put in place here in California, they can literally have it automatically put all the air raid sirens on, which would tell you you've got 5 seconds to take cover. And by the way, 5 seconds is significant. That's enough time to make sure that, hey, you get all of your children in a safe place, keep them away from glass, and you'll be okay. Well, you'll be sort of okay. Yeah, under a table, under a door frame, and you certainly don't want to be around any big glass pane. So get away from the glass. Yes. What's my comment on? Yes. A precursor for a really big quake is often where you see a flurry of quakes along the fault system. So, for example, if we were to see several dozen fours running up and down the San Andreas Fault, that could be the signal that a big one's going to happen imminently. Now, when they mean imminently, they mean within the next year. So it's not like right away. And we've had these flurries where nothing happens. So it's not a definite that you're going to get a big quake, but that often happens. With big quakes, you get a flurry of small quakes running up and down the fault system. That could be. If you get a lot of volcanic activity, that could be a signal. And that's one thing our country's good at. Our big volcanoes are ringed by seismographs, which is why, for example, when Mount St. Helens erupted, they could give all the residents in the area a 2-month warning. Or, for example, if you go to that volcano in Hawaii, they can tell you exactly what to expect from the volcano because they got it all ringed with seismographs. They can actually tell you, well, this is how much lava we expect to be coming out the next week. And this is why they let tourists get so close to the actual volcano, because they got enough data to make sure that, let's not get that close. Let's step back a little bit. So, I've been to that volcano, and you can actually get close enough that your shoe leather gets hot from the lava underneath. And it's the most predictable volcano we know of in the world. And it's because of its high predictability, that's one place that tourists can actually get pretty close. By the way, Hawaii is the fastest growing state in the Union in terms of land area. So, hey, let me get to the text here, because we certainly don't want Rich to leave here without having an opportunity to share. There are three things that are too amazing for me, four that I do not understand: the way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a snake on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a maiden. And we spent a few weeks talking about the ship on the seas, the eagle in the sky, the snake on the rock. It was like pulling teeth for me to get some of you to share about the way of a man with a maiden. And we had some time where we talked about the courtships of animals, or also the courtships of human beings. And the higher animals have sophisticated courtships, but it's nothing compared to what we humans manifest. And I was encouraged that just about when I was going to leave this text and jump to the next part of Proverbs, a whole bunch of you volunteered and gave some amazing accounts about how, indeed, there's a dramatic difference between the courtship that we human beings go through and that of mere animals. And also what we've got to hear is, like four couples here shared, is that with each of you, it was really different. Now, with the animals, if you take any species of animals, the courtship is very predictable. It's like every bird, you know, in their courtship thing of a particular species, you can count on it being the same. With us humans, there's tremendous variety. And we got to hear that from several of you. Some of you had a very long courtship, some of you had a short courtship, and each one was very different. And nothing like what we see with the animals. So with that as a lead-in, Richard, you got to come up here and share with us a way of a man with a maiden. And just so all of you know, Richard here manages paradoxes.org. So if you forget anything he's got to say, and hey, you're free to talk about both of your courtships, I mean, so with your first wife as well as your second wife, whatever you want to do.
They were actually somewhat similar.
Okay.
Because they were short. but not short in terms of months, but not in terms of time. So, but with Kathy, we actually had a high-tech courtship. So it was like 2 weeks of emailing and texting. And then our first date was like 13 hours, and it just got longer from there.
One date was 13 hours?
The first date.
Wow.
So yeah, we went on a hike, and then we went to the ocean, then we went to dinner, and
you had to tell me all the little creatures' names in the water.
Yes. I told her all about the tide pool animals.
So do you two work together, Richard? How do you know each other?
How do we know each other? It's called online dating. But it's good because, you know, it's like doing Chinese takeout. You know, you decide exactly what you want, and I made it really specific, and Kathy made it really specific, and we matched like almost exactly. So it was really good because, you know, if you just randomly find people, then you have no idea what you're getting. Should we advertise? No. Somebody wants to try? Okay, so it was eHarmony. But yeah. And so we dated for a month. Yeah, well, it was 3 months total, but we got engaged like a month and a half after we actually met. So yeah, it was pretty short.
I have a question. Since if the criteria you put was so similar, and I'm assuming you have a lot of similarities of your beliefs, were you able to pinpoint over the years where maybe you were in the same room together and just never met, kind of a thing, or cross paths somewhere else on the earth and within an arm's distance of one another but never met? Was it like that?
No, we never met before.
No, I'm just saying proximity based on who you are and where you go and what you do. Was there some commonality that had you in the same proximity yet you never met?
Maybe you better get Kathy up here to join you.
Yeah.
No, Rich and I both lost our spouses. I was married 35 years, and my husband died of cancer. And everyone knows that Rich had a beautiful marriage, and his wife suffered a long time and then passed away. And so we both kind of unlikely got involved with the eHarmony thing. Just, you said you were doing a scientific experiment.
So there was an article in Scientific American that said that these online dating sites do social experiments with their clients. So they try different things, and you know they send you different kinds of messages and stuff, and see how people react. So I was sort of curious, and I signed up.
So that's why he did it. And I was just sitting at home alone with my dog, and I hadn't signed up, but it sends you a questionnaire about what you like. And so I thought, well, this is interesting. I'll just review, you know. I talked about my faith and how I love the Lord and how I'd like to find someone for friendship and somebody, a man of faith, and someone who enjoys hiking and photography and, you know, doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, you know. I made the parameters so narrow. Someone who's 60, someone who's a widower, you know. I went, I'll never meet anybody. And then, bing! So we went on our first date. We went hiking, and he prepared this beautiful picnic lunch with all these little sliced tomatoes and peppers. And we made a sandwich, and he killed me on the hiking path. He was like going way up there scaling the mountain, and I'm like, can we take a break,
please? Did he make his chocolate chip cookies?
Yes. Of course, and he was sad that I didn't eat five of them.
She doesn't like them.
They're okay.
Okay.
We'll
make up for it.
No, they're good.
She's not a chocolate person.
Oh, they're all right. Don't take it personally, sweetheart. When I first met him, he was discussing your talk about relationships and the dating and how animals take a long time to mate or
no,
something.
No, they don't.
Or no,
they
don't. What was it?
Humans do.
Oh, humans, and you wanted to prove him wrong. That was really the point of us getting married so quickly. You wanted to. I consider it a miracle that we met, and I'm so happy. Beautiful, Rich is a wonderful person, as you all know.
And we're going to have a celebration in a couple of weeks so they can all know how happy we are.
Well, we're very happy for both of you.
Thank
so,
you.
And, we could see it coming from a mile away. So, I remember when you first walked into the classes, oh, something's going on here. So we've had a few romances like that start here in Paradox's class, but we're not going to be competing with eHarmony. So, and I'm so glad that Kathy and I didn't go the eHarmony route because we have 29 modes of incompatibility. We would have never gotten together. And Rich, I did the same thing. First date with Kathy, we went on a hike. I made lunch for her. She was very impressed that I made lunch for her. But my lunch was this whole grain bread with liver and fish and kale and
onions.
Kathy just said years later, it's a miracle I ever went on a second date. I thought I was making her a treat, so. And I found out years later she had never eaten liver before in her life. You know, this is really choice baby beef liver. I mean, I got the best, so. Yeah.
Put it to the test right away.
It wasn't her favorite fish either, so. I mean, it really was a miracle. But that's the wonderful thing about human courtship. I mean, if it's done right, you can see the miraculous hand of God at work. So, and I think, you know, what I saw happening on Facebook with the two of you, I think it really brings that out. So, okay, hey, I was going to talk about Greenland. We'll get to that. We've been talking about Greenland. I'll have to wait till next time. Although I think I'm gone this next week. Is that right? Yeah. I'm going to be in Toronto next Sunday. So it'll be 2 weeks from today. So. Now, what's happening in Toronto is I'm actually being interviewed on my latest book, The A Matter of Days. And I'm being interviewed by a bunch of TV people who all have come out of the Young Earth community. So it should be interesting. Although I've been up there about 2 years ago, and we had a nice discussion. In fact, I actually said, oh, we're really looking forward to the book. So. But yeah, the first time I went up there to be interviewed, the guy who founded the network decided to debate me on the physics of the age of the universe. And I kept trying to get him off the debate. I was there for a whole different subject matter. But it was very uncomfortable because, you know, here's this layperson trying to tell me all my astrophysics was wrong. So, and I was trying to be diplomatic. And anyway, the last interview went really well. The son interviewed me, and he said, I'd never heard a biblical defense of an old Earth model of Genesis before. He was very intrigued, and he's very excited. So I think this interview is going to go really well. But that'll be happening next week. So let me close this in prayer. I'll give you a little tidbit of what's happening here, is that a new paper got published where it says, thanks to the elevation of Greenland, actually all the wind patterns in the northern hemisphere were changed in such a way as to make possible a large population in Western Europe. So we'll talk about next time we get back to that. And also how there's evidence that because of what's happening in the Arctic Sea, we're actually seeing the beginnings of what may be the start of the next ice age. There's actually some signs that that's already beginning to kick in. So how fast is it going to happen? Well, people have been asking me that. It takes several hundred years before it really begins to have a negative influence. But the fact is, we're actually seeing some signs already. And it's taking place in Siberia. And I wouldn't worry until you see it in Labrador. The models tell us that the first sign will be Western Siberia. And that's what we're seeing already. Western Siberia is already getting that evidence. The second sign would be Northern Labrador. So anyway, we'll talk about that next time. But I think the context for all of this is, if this is really the case, then we got a relatively short window of time to take the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world. The climate stability we've been enjoying for the past 9,000 years apparently is coming to an end. And so that means we have only a brief period of time to complete the task. So if the Bible doesn't motivate you, maybe the book of nature will motivate you. With that, let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we do thank you for creating this amazing universe, this amazing planet. Thank you, Lord, that you design all these things we refer to as natural disasters to be just right, to make it possible to have a large human population with the civilization we need to take the good news of salvation to all the people groups of the world. And we thank you, Lord, that this world we're living in right now is not our future home. Our future home lies beyond in the new creation. And Father, I pray that you would work within us, those of us who are followers of you, that we may complete the task that you've given us so we can move quickly rather than slowly from this creation to the new creation. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.